matter what people say, you got it going on. Who cares about what they think?
You know me, I'm the hottest in the street.
WJMS. This is According to RP.
Turn up the volume, kick back, and get raw with us.
From the latest hip hop beats, to social issues that cripple the black community, all from the perspective of a young, strong black woman.
A strong.
All right, everyone, I'm here with my very special guest, Barnabas. I will not give your last name, though, because I don't want people coming after you.
Right. I mean, it's cool, because I guess I'm peace in the community. So
I mean, if you want to put your government out there, go ahead, put your government out there.
My name is Barnabas Crosby. I'm a native of Cleveland, Ohio. I got to say that because, you know, it's a lot of us out here, but we be trying to hide from each other.
Why is that?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, Cleveland, the upbringing of Cleveland, you know, was a very cold city. It's a very, you know, we had to walk to school in like 3 feet of snow. And when I moved on the East Coast, that was like a phenomenon that people shut down the city when it was like 2 inches.
Or dust.
And so the nature of a person that grew up in the Midwest is like, you know, you're out for a certain number of months and then the rest of the months you just like hibernating because it's just too fucking cold. I mean, can I curse on here?
You can curse. Cool. We're good.
So it's just too cold. So I don't think that Cleveland people are necessarily like hiding from each other. It's just our nature to kind of incubate for the bulk of the year.
I see. But when summer's out, though, they're out.
I mean, but you still got to figure out who they are. But, you know, we're here.
You're here. So the moral of that, I guess, that story is that the Clevelanders are here in Brooklyn, New York. They're here in New York City.
Yeah.
And if you see them, point them out.
And get to know them, because Cleveland people, man, we pretty dope. Pretty even keel. I mean, we got an edge to us, but our edge is... are a little more covert than your average New Yorker.
What's that edge, though?
It's the cold. You know, growing up in the cold, you understand that you got a very collapsed amount of time to get everything that you need to get before you have to go and hibernate.
Mm.
So we're cordial, but we ain't about that bullshit.
So you ain't got time to really like hang out and do these pleasantries. You're like, listen, I need to grab my stash for the winter, and that's it.
Which is interesting, and it's interesting because your family is Caribbean, and my family originated from the South, but my mother would often reference this thing that people who grew up in the colder months, they usually are not richer, but it's richer in a way of like harvesting things and stowing them away versus like, you know, waiting for the fish to come. You got this abundance of, you know, natural resources around you. In Ohio, in the Midwest, you don't.
Okay.
So you just have to kind of like stash away. So when I say rich, I ain't shooting shots at nobody.
Maybe
so
like resourceful.
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 There we go.
There you go. There you go.
So I don't need nobody coming for me.
I mean, you gave your government out there, so they will find you on social media.
Right.
All right, so what do you want me to call you? Barnabas, Barney, I mean, I don't know.
Barn is cool.
Barn is cool. What about Barney? You don't like Barney?
Barney is, I'm a person that's big on names. My name is Barnabas, which is a biblical name, Book of Acts, for those who are religious.
Okay.
Which I'm not. but Barnabas is a Hebrew name that means son of consolation, son of exaltation, son of prophecy. So when people call me Barney, which has another kind of derivative.
I see.
It's just weird. If you call me Barn, that means we're more familiar.
Okay. So Barney is like somebody who's like, they faking that they know you. They don't know you.
They probably,
but they acting like they know you.
They probably jabbing at you. Hey, Barney, what's going on?
I see.
And you call me Barn, it's like you really know, you know me.
So I'm a homie if I call you Barn.
You call me Barn.
Okay.
If I allow you to call me, so I'll allow you.
Thank you. Barn. I'll be calling you Barn from now on. So Barn, tell us a little bit about what you do.
So at the gate, I was a writer, storyteller. I went to school because I was writing poetry in high school.
Oh.
So I went to school for theater. They were trying to pull me in a bunch of different directions, from acting, directing, but I settled into playwriting. There was something about words and narratives that really kind of drove at me, and understanding that there are so many different things that I could do with words. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just from a practical standpoint, being a playwright, I was in a better position in college to produce, to act, to do different things versus like being a strictly a performance major to where I had to perform. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a writer, I'm a storyteller, I'm a performer, I'm an educator. You know, I have been in and out of the classroom for many, many years. And I'm just a creative. I mean, I'm a person that like to sit and talk shit.
Yeah.
We doing
yeah.
that. I like to ham it up, but what really drives me is not only seeing, but being able to document Black people enjoying one another, mm-hmm. which is, you know, where Whiskey Boys kind of came from. So
okay, so tell us a little bit more about Whiskey Boys.
Whiskey Boys was really like, initially, when I started Whiskey Boys, it was like, yo, trying to get my friends who were starting to couple up, who were getting deeper into their careers, to come out and just hang out. Mm-hmm. I ain't seen y'all in a long time. Y'all hibernating. Right? And the one thing that would get them out was to say, like, yo, we about to go to, like, a whiskey bar. And that was, like, a hot topic. And, you know, GQ, Esquire magazines at the time, they were publishing all types of articles about whiskey. And so I was like, you know, it seems like it's getting ready to be a big thing, you know. And sure enough, like, within six to nine months, there were a lot of whiskey bars that were popping up in Brooklyn. And me being a person, you know, I'm not a big drinker per se, but, you know, I like to know what I'm talking about. The more I studied about whiskey, I learned that there were like all these healing properties and all these like different things. And it had been around forever. And so like there were a lot of like educational things that I kind of grew very fond of. And so because the people who I was associated with, they were like smart people. The idea that we could actually be out and learn something at the same time. And I'm a musician as well.
What do you play?
I play guitar and I play ukulele and I sing.
The ukulele?
Yeah, I used to perform when I was living in Philly. But the fact that people could come together and learn something at the same time became something that was like, huh, what if I could do that deliberately? Bring people out to meet people. Because like one of the first meet and greets I had out was very informal, and I invited these guys out, and there was a guy who black guy who was a surgeon. He had gone to Harvard, and there was another black guy who was there, because most of my demographic is black. There was another guy there who was like an environmental engineer.
Okay.
And they had just so happened to meet each other, get each other's names, and then they found out what they did, and they were just like, yo, shit, we're both black scientists. This shit is fucking amazing. I never really get to meet black scientists. So that interaction really kind of became like the driving force. It was like, what if I can take people who are in various industries that would socially get along, would engage, but because they're so deep into their careers and their professions, get them together so they can start to build on that platform. So that became like a driving force. But understanding that, you know, from a classroom perspective, there are people who want to engage. Some people don't want to engage, but they want to be around. There was a goal to create not only an event, but an experience to where people could observe and consume information and could consume, you know, the company of others, but they didn't have to engage if they didn't want to, but they still walked away with a robust experience. And just the stories that came out of that just kind of drove me into all kinds of other weird spaces.
Okay. So, yeah. Okay. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was always wondering, like, where Whiskey Boys, like how they originate, you know, where, like what was the inspiration for it? I mean, obviously whiskey is part of it, but you know, what exactly the Whiskey Boy entertainment,
right,
you know, was about.
Well, the entertainment came later, because one of my social media account got hacked. The funny thing is like, even like, and it got hacked at the right time. It's like divine intervention. You know, my mother talks about that all the time.
Listen, God be knowing.
He be knowing.
JC be knowing.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, at the time that it got hacked, a lot of like, you know, like the content that I was producing at the time was about night culture. And, you know, my friends and I, you know, everybody was starting to really, really seriously couple up or really, really get into their family lives. And so the night culture just didn't seem important. And so there's a old Gaelic term that says, well, whiskey will not cure. There is no cure for. So I said, okay, if whiskey is medicine, what is the sustaining healing property mm-hmm. of Whiskey Boys, and it was the community. And so I said, man, you know, if it doesn't matter if we have glasses in our hands or not, we're together.
Yeah.
And so the shift was towards community culture versus night culture. Hmm. So the name Whiskey Boys, it could sustain because it had that healing property.
Ah, right? Look at you.
It's just like, yo, man, motherfuckers is nerds out there. And what was missing from all of the earlier Whiskey Boy content was how I saw the event. So it became this driving force for me, and you know, and this is me, you know, taking my Superman cape off on, I guess. So it became a driving force for me to actually get behind the camera,
okay,
and document what I saw, and let that be the driving force for how people understood Whiskey Boys.
So that explains mm-hmm. your photography mm-hmm. and your role yeah. in all of this. Okay. Uh-huh. Okay, it makes sense now because I follow you on social media and mm-hmm. I like to put things together. I'm an mm-hmm. analytical individual. So mm-hmm. I look to see like, okay, how is this good? I see that you like telling stories mm-hmm. through pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I see that.
Yeah. You know, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. You know, being a poet, as you know, I mentioned mm-hmm. I was a musician. So being a poet allowed me to like give a perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I became a playwright, it was like I had more control over perspective.
Okay.
I could give multiple accounts of an event, multiple perspectives, all this different stuff. But the fucked up thing is, you know, I'm from inner city Cleveland, you know, I'm from around the way
mm-hmm.
and theater is an economic thing. So I'm going to ask, you know, the motherfuckers that I grew up, the people I grew up around
mm-hmm.
to spend $35-$45 to come sit in the dark to bear witness to some shit they may or may not like, or they may or may not care about.
Yeah.
And so that was like really, really important that my people could come see my work. So even like when I was in grad school, you know, I produced a play at the Cleveland Playhouse. It was standing room only at mm-hmm. the production. All of these people that were there were people from my community, but they were there for free.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's important because the stories that I tell, the images that I like to showcase are people from my perspective, people that are everyday people, people that I enjoy being around. And I try to only photograph people that I know something about,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not a tourist per se. But it was important for me to tell stories about people that had a similar journey that I have.
Okay.
Whether I'm at, you know, a gala, or whether I'm shooting the shit around the way, that shit was important, you know?
So as I'm here in your studio, mm. looking at some of your images, what is your end goal with all of this? Like, I mean, are we going to be seeing a gallery of Barnes pictures? Yeah. Are we going to be, so what are we going to get from all of this?
So that's funny. So I have a really good friend in Atlanta, a playwright friend named Adaye Moon. Beautiful writer. I mean, like amazing writer. Very rich in his content. You know, he's from Florida. So that whole Zora Neale Hurston aesthetic mm-hmm. is like all throughout his work. And he was in grad school when I was in undergrad. And, you know, he's kind of watched my development as a storyteller over the years. And he says to me, you know, Barn, your work can't exist on stage. Not anymore. You're doing something that's so far, because, you know, at the time, you know, I got into the classroom and I, you know, do work in museums and I do work on film sets and stuff like that. You know, when friends, you know, are able to kind of get me jobs. And he saw that my work was taking like various transformations,
mm-hmm.
not out of, you know, pocket or out of range of what, you know, I intended to do, but he says your work has to exist somewhere else. It's too much. And I had gone to this Tim Burton exhibit in Philadelphia about 12 years ago. And this Tim Burton exhibit not only had his film work, but all the renderings, the sketches, the clay models, everything that he had worked on. So Beetlejuice mm-hmm. and all this weird shit. I said, man, what kind of mind created this shit? Right? And that just be, I said, oh, Barn, you have to prepare yourself to be an exhibit. You have to prepare an exhibit for your life's work. And so, in the fall, I have a friend. So we're, you know, in my studio's, on the corner is in between, Ocean Parkway and Flatbush on Parkside Avenue. I have a friend that owns a restaurant on the corner of Flatbush and Parkside named, Boris, Rizbo. Wonderful restaurant. He's a French guy, but he's making Brooklyn comfort food. So the food is homey. And so the images that you're seeing, are images that I've taken around Brooklyn of people, and the title of this exhibit is Salt. How we come together. And so when we come together as a community, we often come together. When you think of salt, and when we come together, it's often over food.
Yeah.
So this exhibit has to exist inside of a restaurant.
Interesting.
Right? And so these are people that you would see at, and you know, at a restaurant, you would hang out. Some of these people, you might even look in their faces and you say, like, I could see myself across the table with that person. And so, this will be the first layer of this physical, visual representation of my, the stories that I've been collecting over the years.
I see. I like. Okay.
Yeah.
So now I know you got something coming up very soon, Baldwin and Friends. I want to talk about it because I think, one, it should be talked about.
Okay.
And two, I attended your first. I don't know if it was your first, but I attended my first Baldwin and Friends at the Gentleman's Factory. This was, what, April? And I was telling you offline beforehand, I was like, I knew that Barn was doing something because Kenny told me about it. And then Jeff told me about it. But then I'm like, I don't know what this is, though. Like, what is this? Aside from Barn doing something, what is it? And it wasn't until the day of, I kept getting these alerts. James Baldwin, Baldwin and Friends. I'm like, what is this thing? And so when I showed up, I was pleasantly surprised about the conversation and everything that took place. Like, it was a really robust conversation. And I think that the topics and the questions that, you know, were posed and then just the back and forth, just the engaging with people that I didn't know.
Right.
I didn't know everybody in the room, which I like because I like hearing other people's perspectives. And I just thought that, you know, at first I was like, yeah, I don't know what this is. Am I going to stay here?
So I'm interested in that. I want to dig at that. Like, so what, so you read James Baldwin, you know, like, so when you got that information, like, what was your, like...
So when
did it seem a little like daunting of a task?
It was a little daunting because I'm like, I didn't read no materials before I got here. You know, like the last time I did anything with Baldwin was when in my undergrad because I was an Africana studies minor. But aside from that, I'm like, so what exactly are we going to be talking? Do I need to be prepared? Do I need to start Googling stuff so I can have a meaningful seat at the table? And so I thought that we'd be talking about James Baldwin and probably talking about one of his works. And so that's why I was a little bit nervous because I'm like, I want to be here. But I didn't read up on any of this. So that's what I thought it was. So I was like, okay, I'll just go and I'll sit back. I'm going to support.
Right.
I'm going to support Barn. I'm going to support the Combine. And I will
And Jeff.
And I'll just sit here and, you know, listen. But then when you posed the question, you know, like, you know, what is the, like, what is the cost? And you were talking about, like, freedom. We were talking about American Dream. Then I was like, oh, I can say something.
So
yes, I have a lot to say.
So I'm not here to interview you. I mean, we're just having a conversation.
We're having a conversation.
So, what provided that shift for you? Because I think that, I want to talk, but I'm always curious about how people, the experience they extracted from the Baldwin talks.
Well, I think the shift happened when I saw that this was a forum that was actually asking for people's opinions. You asked the question, you know, like, what's the cost of the American dream? Or I think it was first, like, what is the American dream? You first asked about what is the American dream. And I automatically, you know, I guess, I don't know, just started thinking about my experiences, my family's experiences here in America and as to what I believe the American dream is.
Right.
And so I guess when you pose the question in that way, it wasn't, because I saw that there were, you know, not really panelists, but I recognize individuals who would be steering the conversation. But then I was like, no, this is for everyone to answer. And I felt compelled. I think I actually answered that specific question. I gave my take on what I thought the American dream was. But then I think after I gave my response and then just seeing how people were piggybacking and giving their, I'm like, okay, this is an exchange. This is a group. It's like, it reminded me of a think tank. I like think, think tanks. Mm-hmm. And that's what I thought it was. I'm like, this is a think tank to, one, I guess, figure out what it is that, you know, people are thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, look and, I guess, examine some of the experiences that we're bringing about here. Right. And then at some point, kind of tie it all in to a theme or a concept, you know, of James Baldwin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so that was kind of what was going through my mind. I'm like, ah, this is a, I see like where the little parts are, but at the end of the day, it's going to get tied in under this particular guise or whatever.
Yeah. So the interesting, I first came across James, I read Giovanni's Room.
Okay.
And it was like, you know, I described it as like somebody pouring ice cold water on your back. That's how the language was that rich and precise. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, as a young writer, I think I was maybe like 23, 24 at the time when I read this book. And as a young writer, I'm saying, man, that would be an amazing thing to achieve. And I was an intern at New Dramatists, which is a playwrights organization in Manhattan. And they asked me to go through all the, I think they were trying to give me something to do. Because, you know, they was like, let's get this guy something to do. So they said, go through all these file cabinets in the basement. So I went through all these file cabinets in the basement. They said, we need to figure out what's in there because we don't want to just throw the file cabinets out. And this organization has been around, you know, since the, like, the 60s, like, maybe like the late 50s. I can't remember. And I come across this folder, and I open up the folder and I look at the name, and it was an application to become a member of New Dramatists. And this was a handwritten application with a manuscript of James Baldwin.
Oh, wow.
So I'm like touching like pages and shit that James Baldwin had written. And I just read Giovanni's Room. And I was like, what the fuck? And I found myself back in school, in the fall, in grad school. And I'm, you know, writing my master's thesis, which is a play called Foxhole. It was Hands first, and then I changed the title to Foxhole. And I'm watching this old-ass documentary called The Price of the Ticket about James Baldwin. And it was about his life, and he talked about, in that documentary, they talked about the role, the responsibility of the artist. And I never understood, you know, like, I think at the time, you know, I was really conflicted because I was like, you know, am I going to make some money? Am I going to make money as a writer, you know? Am I going to be able to feed my family? Am I going to be able to, you know, buy bougie clothes and shit like I like? You know what I'm saying? Like, you know what I'm saying? I didn't want to be like this threadbare guy, you know, showing up in holy sweaters. I like nice sweaters. You know, I like cashmere skull caps and little bullshit like that. Like bullshit, you know? It's like, am I going to be able to do this and have this career? And he talked about the role and the responsibility of an artist. And I said, I have a deeper understanding of what I'm supposed to be doing. My name is Barnabas, son of prophecy, son of exaltation, son of, you know, consolation. I said, man, you got to do something with that. And so The Price of the Ticket, that essay, which I later found, I mean, that documentary, which I later found was an essay, never left me. I finished grad school in 05. And here it is, 2019, you know, 14, almost 15 years later. And, you know, Baldwin and Friends is in his third year. And I've sourced that essay, Price of the Ticket, for at least 2 years now. Because it's so rich, so pulpy. I came to Baldwin and Friends. I lost the job. Partly because the reason why I bought the camera is because I said, if I lose another job, I never want to be without a source of income. And I'm a storyteller, so I can always tell any kind of story I want to. So I came to Baldwin and Friends. I was out of a job, and I was looking for grants to do some sort of like creative content. And I came across Humanities New York, and they gave this training, moderation training. And it puts you in on par with all of the people who are doing humanities work across the state of New York.
Okay.
And I came across this Baldwin stuff, and I said, huh, this is interesting. And I like playing with titles. I said, Baldwin and Friends. I'm going to do an event. I was already doing events. I said, what if I do an event called Baldwin and Friends? I use, and we're Baldwin. We're his friends.
Yeah.
Right? Because we've all been nursed off this guy's off his writing, his ideas. We've grown up with his ideas, whether it be, from our professors, whether it be from our high school teachers, whether it be our parents. Baldwin's words have been with us in some sort of way. And so the idea was to get people in a room, very much similar to how all of us had in undergrad. Mm-hmm. We had these like town hall meetings to get people to talk about what their experience is with democracy as a black person or as a woman or as a white person, you know, of the middle class. What are our perspectives on these things? Are we synonymous in some ways, or are we just really fucking out of our minds, you know, walking around as individuals trying to figure out, like, well, who are we connected to? Mm-hmm. What I found was people had been burning to share. People had longed for these type of environments, these types of platforms to share and to have their ideas expressed and challenged, for mm-hmm. that matter, in ways that allowed them to grow within the hour. So they can go back into their works and whatever it is with a little bit more resilience, a little bit of armor, you know, to mm-hmm. kind of do their work. And because they felt validated in a lot of different ways. Yeah.
So that's how the James Baldwin and Friends came mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. And so we have another event.
Ah, yeah.
Yes. We have another event coming out on June 29th.
Uh-huh.
Okay. You want to talk about that a little
bit? Yeah, I do. First of all, let me just say this. The one that you went to was amazing.
Yeah.
Was amazing.
How many have you had before that one?
So last year I did a series of four. The year before that I did a series of four. And this year...
Damn, I'm late in the game.
Yeah. You are. And then actually in the fall I did something different. I did the Silence Project.
Okay.
Which is R.G. Lord material. And I would pose a question to a person. I would do one-on-ones and I would say, talk about silence. And then they talk about silence and I would contextualize it according to race, gender, socioeconomics, all of this stuff.
Hmm.
And it was really about the one-on-one with the person, because the Baldwin and Friends, you competing mm-hmm. to hear people's perspectives. But with the Silence Project, I was able to narrow in. So the one that you came to, why was it amazing? It was amazing because a lot of people really showed up with their A game. They was ready to talk. They were ready to share. I had Kenny, Keith, Mally, you know, the Brooklyn Combine along my side. But the one thing I told them, I said, yo, we ain't taking no authorities over this information. We don't own this shit. Our opinions don't mean nothing because mm-hmm. we are a part of the conversation, which is the directive that I had given. And so that one was so amazing. I said, you know, Jeff asked me to do another one. And Jeff, you know, Jeff ain't really all on the up and up with his communication.
Yeah.
And so as I was recruiting players for this next conversation, I reached out to Novella Ford at the Schomburg.
Okay.
And I had been, you know, really trying to, in my mind, the Schomburg was the destination for Baldwin and Friends. Baldwin is from Harlem. Baldwin is a part of like this upper echelon of black culture mm-hmm. and literature and humanity. So he needs whatever I do needs to somehow find a destination at the Schomburg. And I was recruiting all of my people for Jeff's because Jeff had asked for June. And then Novella said, you know, I actually got one better for you. I said, what's that? She says, how about you bring Baldwin and Friends up to Harlem for the literary festival? I said, what? I'm like reading my, I'm reading Instagram in the morning when I'm like, you know, because I'm an educator. I'm like working with my kids and my kids are like wondering, like, why am I having this like silent celebration? You know what I'm saying? And it's only like a person who was like hella fucking nerdy that would get excited about this shit. So, yo. And I said, you know, I tried to explain it to them. They didn't get it. You know, I just said, all right, cool. I'm going to just have a celebration on my own. So I had to take a lap around the building to celebrate myself. So it's going to be at the Schomburg during the Literary Festival, June 29th. What I've done was I looked at some of the footage from the last Baldwin and Friends, and there were like some really profound statements that were made by Kenny Montgomery about innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And then April Walker also, you know, spoke to space for black people doing business with black people or other, and this whole notion of trust
mm-hmm.
within a space. And so I said, you know, I want to actually extract some of those. I want to extract that. And I want to look deeper into that, because Baldwin in the essay, The Price of the Ticket, talks about gatekeepers. He doesn't phrase it as gatekeepers, mm-hmm. but he talks about Buford Delaney and Marianne, the opera singer, Buford Delaney, the painter, and the opera singer Marianne Anderson, literally like opening the door and saying, come on in, this is your heritage. This is what is waiting for you mm-hmm. as you go forward. And it almost gave him permission to go forward and be this rebel rouser that I mean, listen, man, I done seen this dude read all types of motherfuckers in these debates.
Yeah.
You know, Buckley, you know, him sitting down with Malcolm X, and then this conversation that just resurfaced with Nikki Giovanni. Have you seen this?
No.
Oh my God. It's pretty brilliant. And so, you know, James Baldwin is just like, you know, the thing that really gets me about James Baldwin is that, you know, like I said, you know, being a storyteller, being a playwright, the one thing that I've always wanted was my people to see my work.
Mm-hmm.
Because my work was about my people, right? Just like August Wilson. And I was actually compared to August Wilson really, really early in my playwriting career. But there was something that August Wilson did in his work, and something that James Baldwin did in his work, which was to speak a common tongue. And he wrote about the educated or the smart nigga with angst.
Mm-hmm.
And I identify with that. That anger or that frustration that you feel when you've checked off all the boxes. I went to school, I haven't been arrested. You checked off all these boxes and shit. But you still hitting this wall of racism, socioeconomics, gender, you know. I mean, I feel like, you know, there's definitely like something about black or men in black or black in men, however you choose to, you know, utilize that combination, that I find myself grappling with.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's something that James Baldwin has been able to express. And I'm like, well, I ain't got to say what I got to say, because somebody said that shit for me already.
You just gotta co-sign it.
That's it. And like I said, Marianne Anderson and Buford Delaney, during these talks, I said, yo, whoever's coming to participate in this conversation, this is a part of your heritage. James Baldwin's words, this angst that you feel, that's a part of your heritage mm-hmm. as an American, as a black American, as a black in America, a black person in America. So, yeah.
That's some pretty profound stuff, though.
Yeah, I think so.
So now, you're a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
You're a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
You're just a writer in general. Mm-hmm. Do you still write poetry?
I do.
Okay.
I do.
Okay.
It has its place.
Does it have its place on this platform? Do you have something you could spit off?
Hell
off the dome? No? No? You don't want to talk about roses are red, violets are blue? See you hating. No.
I mean, I think that where poetry exists for me now, it exists in that visual space.
Okay. Interesting.
I do, you know, like there is I was groomed and grew up as a performer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been on stage for the bulk of my life. I've been speaking and engaging with people publicly for a long, long time. There is something about poetry that I think, I don't want to say it's sacred, you know, because I kind of grew up in that era of spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen spoken word morph into some crazy shit. You know, now y'all selling Big Macs and shit, you know. You know what I'm saying? And in Hondas. And when you know, poetry was like really, you know, when you went to these poetry places, there was something happening in mm-hmm. the late 90s, you know, when people would, you know, spend, you know, hours over their notebooks laboring over what am I going to say? How am I going to say it? And how am I going to connect with the audience? And, you know, and I mentioned, you know, going, transitioning from the poetry to the playwriting. But what I didn't mention was like the music, being able to control people with mm-hmm. sound and no words, be letting the music kind of set the tone and create this level of emotion, that communication that happens with just a vibration
mm-hmm.
of the eardrum. So like the poetry, you know, I don't write to perform anymore. I write to say like, huh, like this is a concept. How can I showcase that concept visually?
So what you're telling me is that you're not about to drop some bars. No.
I don't want to drop no bars. I be making up songs and shit with the kids to try to get them, like, to clean up the room and stuff like that. So
you made a clean up song?
Hell yeah, man! Like, and I'm gonna try to record that and sell it to Sesame Street. I don't know. I mean, so there's these images at Reesbo during that exhibit. There might be some poetry there.
Okay, I'm going to hold you to it. I'm going to hold you to it.
There'll be some poetry there. What I'm planning to do, because, you know, Whiskey Boys, like, I don't really, like, so I don't even realize, like, on the Instagram handle, you don't see my face.
Yeah, I was wondering at first. I'm like, because I'm like, okay, Whiskey Boys, I know now that it's you, but I didn't know exactly that it was you before. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I think I had your personal Instagram handle, but then I'm like, is there like a group of Whiskey Boys? Like, who is that? Mm-hmm. Who is this group? Mm-hmm. So it is a little bit vague, and it says a little obscure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because Whiskey Boys is an idea.
Mm.
You know, similar, like, I don't know if you're a fan of the Christian Bale Batman movies.
No.
But and like, I think like the last one, which is one, like the Dark Knight Returns.
Well, I watch all of those movies, yeah. But I don't know if I say, like, I'm a fan, like, I know all the details, but I like Batman.
Right, so there was a part where Alfred told Bruce that Batman is an idea.
Mm.
And that he's not the man. It's not about the man, it's the idea. The man could die, but the idea lives on. And so, Whiskey Boys, I said, if I remove my face from Whiskey Boys, if I don't show myself how I've now been and da-da-da-da-da, then the community will see themselves inside.
I see.
Do you understand? So then it becomes like the community's brand.
This is the community Whiskey Boys.
So it's an idea. I mean, like, yo, people, you know, over the years, people have, like, oh, you know, they thought it was like an aesthetic in terms of dress and style. So people, you know, they would come like, oh, I'm on my Whiskey Boy shit. And they, you know, they thought it was all about the fedoras and whatnot. But it wasn't really about that. It was about you bringing your authentic, high functioning self, whether you was in Chucks or using some fucking wingtips, bring that shit. You know, like, what you thinking about what you got in your glass and shit. And so me doing this exhibit in September, what's gonna be weird is that I'm gonna play guitar and I'm gonna sing, and I've been singing.
You sing as well?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
I have all types of creative.
I have some. And so I'm a get up there and I'm gonna sing and I'm gonna play guitar. And that's kind of like going against what I've been trying to do with Whiskey Boys, which is to take the me away.
Mm-hmm.
This camera's an amazing thing that allows you to disappear.
But sometimes I realize, and I've had to learn that in, you know, moving forward with my branding, with the stuff that I do, that people, you have to insert yourself at some point.
Of course.
It might not be, you know, on like a large scale. Like, right. You're not going to over, I don't know, take over your Instagram and, you know, whatever with Barn,
right?
But you have to, like, let people know that there is a face to all of this. Mm-hmm. You might not see it all the time, but there is a person, there is a story, there is something with it.
Yeah,
so you can't disappear too much.
That's, I mean, I would agree. I think that what happens is that, you know, when I'm, you know, photographing or if I'm, you know, filming.
Mm-hmm.
There is something that happens in me not. So if I show up with my camera somewhere, if I'm in an event, whether I'm hired to do a job, commissioned to do a job or not, if I show up somewhere, the goal is to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is to not be like, sometimes you'll see, like, I might be recording or I might be shooting and then I might come from, I'll like kind of unveil myself and I'll say some bullshit, which is what I often do, and people will react and I'm like click 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 click, right, you know, I'm right back to, you know, to being veiled. But there's something about being able to disappear and really, like, you know, like, you know, a lot of my images feature, you know, members of the Combine, which people in the public space see these guys as like superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know them, then that's what they are. But if you don't know them and you're just looking at these guys from a distance, you're like, oh my God. But then I'm able to capture this very human side of like a Kenny Montgomery.
Yeah.
Or a Keith White. To where you see them with their kids. You see them, you know, really having these really intimate moments with each other where they're laughing. And then, you know, what happens is it's like, you know, because I'm on this thread with these guys. Now, you know, after a couple of days, I might share images with them. And, you know, you'll hear Kenny, who's not, Kenny's not an emotive guy.
Yeah.
He's just not, that's just not his way. He said, you know, he said, he'll be like, I appreciate this photo, you know, cause I'm, you know, I got a smile on my face. I'm with my brother, you know, and my kids are in the background, you know, having a good time with my wife. And, you know, so you understand that what you're doing is providing a service.
Mm-hmm.
You're not just taking photographs of people, because you're just like, you know, like, oh, this would be cool for the gram. Like you're creating like this memory.
Yeah. Yeah. Legacy memory. And, yeah. And that's something that I think that is lacking mm-hmm. within the community. Mm-hmm. Me and my cousin were having this conversation. Like there's not much talk about legacy anymore yeah. within the Black community.
Yeah, you know,
we don't talk about that enough, but I definitely see how your picture, cause I look at these things. I'm like, huh, maybe one day I will get photographs so that I could, you know,
photographs of you.
I did. I made the cut. I'm in the album.
Yeah.
but one thing, you know, I've always been, curious too, and I guess maybe you can shed a little more light on this, is so the arts, right? Mm-hmm. The arts, being creative. Mm-hmm. I feel like when we're talking about like people, like either whether it be like from the street, from the community, like men in particular, mm-hmm. like you don't hear too many of them talking about like theater, talking mm-hmm. about playwriting, or even being into stuff like mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. right? Like mm-hmm. poetry. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, poetry a little more so because the spoken word movement, right. you know, it's mm-hmm. like rap or whatever. But we're talking about being in the theater. Mm-hmm. We're talking about stuff, theatrical stuff like that. How do you, in what ways have you tried to bring it to the community to kind of expose, like not like children, mm-hmm. but like grown men mm-hmm. to this, you know, to this world?
You know, it's interesting because like, you know, Baldwin and Friends, you know, is a bit of theater,
mm-hmm.
you know, coming from the Black box tradition or being trained in the Black box tradition where you don't have anything and you're supposed to meet, create drama from nothing. From conversation, from distance, from space, things like that. You know, as I've, you know, like, I, you know, like, there's something about writing a play that's really, really interesting because you're really crafting a world
mm-hmm.
where, you know, people can exist. But Baldwin and Friends more recently has become like a really, really interesting bit of theater because when I sat down in my first theater class, one of my professors says, you know, the most powerful tool that you have as a theater artist is the mind of your audience. And there's something that happens in a live performance that you don't get from the gram, that you don't get from going to see a movie or watching mm-hmm. it at home on your television. I traveled to London in my sophomore year. This is like the same year that Aaliyah died.
Mm.
Broke my heart.
Rest in peace.
Because I thought, I knew. I'm like, yo, I'm going to work with homegirl. Like, yo, we both from the Midwest. We one state away. I knew I was going to work with Aaliyah. Right? And her death really was like a great motivator for me because it was like she died doing something that she loved. But I was in London right before her passing. And I went to the Globe Theater, which was Shakespeare's original mm-hmm. theater. And this was the New Globe. And it's a theater in the round. It's kind of like when we were talking before the podcast, we were talking about Baldwin and yeah. Friends being in live.
I'm wondering if I went there because I did, when I was in London, I did see Much Ado About Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the theater was shaped.
Yeah, like this was like an open air theater. Yeah. So it was like, you know, like a Tudor style theater, if any you guys know what I'm saying.
If not, look it up. Google's for everybody.
Yeah. So Tudor Stewart. So like it was a theater in the round. Yo, we were watching fucking King Lear.
I love King Lear.
Right, King Lear's awesome.
One of my favorite.
Right,
that and Othello.
So yeah. So and I have a couple favorite Shakespeare plays. It's really brilliant. But we were watching King Lear, and in the opening sequence, the army came through the audience, right? They were like the ground. You had the people that were in the stands, and then you had what they call the groundlings. Mm-hmm. The groundlings were like the cheap seats back in the day. And so we were sitting in the round, so on the first floor. So I guess we were like the upper class. And I'm like this little nigga from Cleveland and shit, right? And the army, Lear's army, came through the groundlings. And one of the daughter's husbands gave like the opening prologue. And he was standing on this like pillar. He was hanging off this pillar, just standing just above the groundlings. Mm-hmm. And as he's right in the middle of his speech, he reached down, snatches a beer out of somebody's hand. In the middle of his speech, drinks the beer and then passes it back to him. I said, yo, that shit is amazing. It was because it was like, that lets you know, like, yo, we are in a performance. And so like, when you go to live performances now, because of the way social media functions and, you know, people don't really realize that you're actually watching something and you're a couple feet away from this person. Mm-hmm. They can actually hear what the fuck you're saying. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're impacting this performance.
Yeah.
And so all the while that I've been doing like event planning, it's like, how can, you know, like they got this thing in theater. They say you don't ever want to hear butts shifting in the seats. How can I suspend people's like movement with just ideas? Mm-hmm. And so Baldwin and Friends, like, you know, like I told you, like when I look at the footage and you were there, when you look at the footage, you see people, you see all this theater happening behind their eyes. You don't know what they're thinking. You don't know what's going on behind there, but something is happening. Mm-hmm. They have this whole inner movie that's happening. And that right there, like just for me to witness it, it makes me curious. What's going on in that brain? And so I have motivations to get back to live theater. I think that it's a powerful, powerful medium. Mm-hmm. Powerful medium. I think that if we, there's something that's missing in the Black community, I'm going to speak to more specifically, that has to do with ritual. Whether you get that ritual from religion, whether you get that ritual in your education, you know, the ritual, theater borrowed ritual from religion, mm-hmm. you know, and vice versa. So even as an educator, I see the kids really don't understand how to be a good audience members.
Yeah.
They don't understand or respect the person that's on the stage or whatever. And so there is a motivation to get back to that, not to retrain, you know, the culture, but just to for them to understand that we're connected in so many different ways. And live performance is really like the only way you can facilitate that understanding.
Hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Like I'm just rambling.
No, I mean, no, because it's very interesting. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm asking the questions. Mm-hmm. But what I guess, so when could we, I mean, are you currently working on any screenplays? And if so, when can the public, when can the streets?
When the streets.
When can the streets?
Yo, I have been working on like several scripts for the last couple years. And you know, I've been allowing myself to be distracted by like a lot of small projects. But one of the things that I've been really trying to do is like really brand Baldwin and Friends.
Oh, okay.
That's been like a really high motivation because I feel like what Baldwin and Friends provides, and this is funny. So I was writing this play a couple years ago. I wrote this thing called the middle class mystique because I felt like, you know, you can have all of these trappings and all of these identifiers of the middle class, but it don't feel like the middle class. Yeah. Which came from, remember this book that came out, and this is way before our time, but it was called the Feminine Mystique.
Okay.
And this is where, so like the Feminine Mystique, Sex and the Single Girl, you know, when you get Sex in the City, these are like derived. Sex in mm-hmm. the City was derived from these books, right? So there was this chapter in the Feminine Mystique called The Problem with No Name. And I feel like, you know, as Black and brown people, we go to university, we do everything. Like I said, we check off them boxes. Mm-hmm. And then we can't figure out, like, why am I, like, you know, I pay all my bills. I did everything I'm supposed to. I got food in the refrigerator, but I just can't go out. Or I just can't buy that thing that I want. And I feel some type of way about my existence, you know? You might show up to an event looking gorgeous. gorgeous. Like, fuck, but if I can't even get a ginger ale.
Yeah,
like,
seriously, you know, I can't afford anything. I was able to get here, but that was it.
Right, that was it. And so there was something that was, like, driving at me to try to figure out, like, well, who, you know, else is feeling like that? Mm-hmm. And so I started writing this play, and I had these characters outlined and in mind, and I was like, well, I need to know more about what these characters will feel like. And then Baldwin and Friends became, like, actually a research project for this play.
Okay.
And here we are 3 years later. The play is still in need of a completion, but Baldwin and Friends is in its third year.
Okay. So I see what's happening here. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I feel like, and it's the same thing with myself in terms of trying to balance mm-hmm. all of the million projects mm-hmm. that everybody knows I have. Mm-hmm. Right. But it's trying to prioritize. Like mm-hmm. everything is going to have its season. Mm-hmm. It's its time. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's knowing when to fall back on one.
Yeah.
And to push. Because that Baldwin and Friends, mm-hmm. it, you know, when you do mm-hmm. bring it up and it becomes this like thing where everybody's talking about
right.
Everything else you do might be able to follow through based on the notoriety from
being stocked up. A friend of mine told me that he's like, yo man, you just gotta stock this shit up. And Baldwin and Friends has had a lot of traction, so
there we go, back to Baldwin and Friends. That seems to be the ticket. That's the key,
right?
That's exactly. The key.
So you know, everything is falling into place. You know, like, you know, this year has been 2019. Well, I would say within the last 12 months, it's been a phenomenal year. The podcast, Brooklyn Podcast, had started about a year and a half ago around this time. And I did this Gucci shoot for New Metro Home that was in April, and that came out in the fall. The Brooklyn Combine was in Essence in the fall. Mm-hmm. The Schomburg, you know, it's like
big stuff right there.
So it's just like a lot of really great momentum has been built, you know, this year and established. So, you know,
we're looking good.
We looking all
right. We're looking good. We're looking good. All
right, but we can't rest on our laurels.
Nah, you can't get too complacent.
You can't rest on our laurels. And so, like, I grind every day, just like, you know, it ain't shit happening. Because I don't ever want to be that guy that ain't got. I want to be like Prince and shit. So I just keep grinding, you know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think this was a really great conversation. I think we got to know a little bit about Barn Crosby from the Midwest.
Yeah, from the Midwest, from Cleveland.
So tell us, where can we find you?
So Instagram at WhiskeyBoys _ENT. That's my, you know, I've completely dedicated all the content for that site mm-hmm. to being black and white.
Yeah.
Because there's something I'm trying to communicate about, you know, black people being mm-hmm. timeless, ageless. And then Busy Barn, BIZIBARN, which is my Instagram for my life and color. That's kind of like my vomit.
Okay. Like, you just regurgitate everything.
Yeah. So whenever I'm like trying to scratch at an idea that's going to make it over to Whiskey Boys, I just vomit it out on Busy Barn.
Okay.
But then Whiskey Boys, ENT.com, which is the website, which I'm, you know, I really need to get better with that. But it's like so much stuff going on in my creative brain. I need to be able to pass that
mm-hmm, to somebody else.
Which, you know, and it's a lot, like I said, you know, the year has been great. And so the next year is going to be great. So I'm like hoping that what this year manifests is, you know, the finances for me to pay somebody to do the work.
Or if you are an intern trying to get, if you are an intern out there trying to get into the movement, then definitely, if you did not catch any of his Instagram handles, slide into my DM at According to RP, and I will put you in contact with him.
And yo, how much time you got? Because I do want to say one thing.
You can say one more thing.
So what I do want to make clear about Whiskey Boys is propaganda. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it, you understand exactly the message that I'm pushing. There is a narrative about black people, as Kenny Montgomery would say, that I'm trying to shift. He's like, shift the narrative. Mm-hmm. And what that idea is, that the idea that I'm trying to implant is that we are great, we are wonderful, we are beautiful as our regular everyday selves. And I think that is something that almost negates what Instagram is doing.
Yeah. It definitely does. I mean, Instagram definitely, you have to be like Instagram ready. Everything has to be on point. You know, if you know, your eyebrows got to be on point, your clothes got to be on point, your hair got to be on point.
Yeah.
It's like it doesn't necessarily allow for you to be your natural, authentic self. Because if you do post that, people are wondering like, what is
this? The whole idea of an influencer and, you know, I just think that, you know, and it, and this, you know, this is my own thing. I think, you know, there's a, you know, there's something about that Barbie doll aesthetic that a lot of people are pushing for.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, it's penetrated Black culture like crazy.
It has.
But this plastic Barbie doll propped up kind of aesthetic that we're seeing in the culture, that we're being fed in the media. You know, I want Whiskey Boys to be the antithesis of that. You know, when you look at all of the video content, the imagery, there's something like that's very perceptually, I want it to be intimate. I want people to see that, oh, me and the ponytail ain't so bad.
Yeah, you know, and my natural hair ain't so bad.
Ain't so bad. Yeah. Like, you know, that's not because there's something that is being communicated in the eyes and the posture and the distance of these two subjects inside of this image. That is a lasting thing. I think, you know, the these plastic bodies, that shit ain't gonna, I mean, listen.
It ain't gonna last literally.
The 40-year-old girl with the 20-year-old ass or 15-year-old ass, that shit, I mean, come on, man. We understand. The lines of separation ain't gonna be showing up real quick.
Exactly,
you know?
Exactly.
I mean, like, yo, embrace.
Embrace what
all
you got.
All of your naturalness. If gravity take over your body, then, you know, Some man is there to pick up.
Listen, we'll lift it up. No, lift it up. Someone will be there to lift it up for you.
You know, so like I'm just saying, like yo, if we just because if we understand, like you know, like my mom is like in her mid 60s and she's like you know beautiful and youthful and she's wise beyond her years. It don't matter. Like if you can wake up every day and be a gorgeous human being, who give a fuck about how old you are? Period. If you got something to give to this world. Who gives a fuck about how old you are? You know? So what Whiskey Boys is really trying to communicate is that, yo, we just dope because we just dope. And so that's why, you know.
We are who we are.
We are who we are.
And that's that.
So, yeah. So that's my rant for the day.
Well, I mean, I feel like I said, I feel like I've definitely learned a lot more about you today that we will talk about offline.
Right.
And I feel like the general public now has a better understanding of who this Whiskey Boy entertainment thing is, who Busy Barn is, and a little more about James Baldwin and Baldwin and Friends. I think it's really important to, you know, the arts for me have always been important.
Of course.
I've always been involved in plays, singing, music since I was a kid as well too, and feel like it definitely I do. we'll talk offline. We'll talk offline.
Come on now. Okay.
No. But I think it's important for, you know, for the Black community, for those of us who I guess are artistic in a sense, to really like push that within the community. I feel like there's a lack of push toward the humanities and towards the arts. In my opinion. I feel like, you know, those of us who went to school, who went to whatever, like, we were exposed, it's great. But I feel like there's not much of it really. I mean, we focus on the children a lot, and that's important. But I feel like there's just a lot of people my age who are in these streets who did not have the opportunities to be exposed to this at a young age. And I feel like there should be some sort of, like, push or drive to, you know, introduce them to the arts and humanities.
You know, the same guy I spoke to, Adai Moon, you know, he said, years ago to me when I was living in Philadelphia at the time, he was just like, you know, one of the first things he asks, you know, a woman is what she's reading. He says, if she say she reading a magazine, I ain't fucking with her, right?
No wonder people been asking me these questions. Right? I've had some people ask me questions about what am I reading lately.
Well, and his thing was is like if you exclusively read magazines, you know, there may be a very limited conversation that we can have because the one thing that he did say was that reading makes you confront yourself, your own thoughts, your own beliefs, your own ideas about pick a topic, fill in the blank, right? And I think what I'm more or less trying to do with Baldwin and Friends is to not necessarily educate people, but to share and trade.
So the exposure in sons. I think the exposure is what's important. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can, you know, they can educate themselves if they want to afterwards. But I feel like the exposure, I feel like there's a lack of exposure. Because I feel like I have homies, if you're like, yo, let's go. Like, for me, I'm like, I love Alvin Ailey.
Right, right, right.
Hey, let's go to Alvin Ailey. What am I going to do with Alvin Ailey? What's Alvin Ailey? What's that?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, why would I be interested in that? Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's because of the lack of exposure in the community. If I say, hey, let's go catch a Shakespearean play. Like, yo, King Lear's in town. They're going to look at me like King Lear. They're
going to look at you like you're crazy.
Like, what the hell am I going to do with a King Lear?
And so now, you mentioned that when you came to the Baldwin and Friends, you hadn't read anything. Mm-hmm. And you're an intelligent person.
I am. Thank you.
Right? perceivably. No, I'm
listen,
joking.
Listen. No,
so you hadn't read the material. Did you feel having not read the material put you at a disadvantage?
I didn't, only because I was, I studied James Baldwin when I was an undergrad. Mm-hmm. And so although I was like, I haven't read up on him since.
Right.
I felt like I felt confident enough to engage in conversation that hopefully did not stem exactly from like the a particular text. But a theme or an idea. I felt like I was, equipped to be able to like speak on themes and speak on ideas derived from the text, but not to actually discuss
and
the text.
And so I think the ideas from the text are really in this context, in this on this platform is important is to explore the ideas. Similarly, like with Whiskey Boys, when we were doing exclusive whiskey tastings, the idea was to eliminate what I call like the measuring rods. So like coming with a luxury aesthetic is like everybody gets this. So everybody eats. Once you're in the room, everybody eats. Everybody drinks. If you have to break from your conversation to go buy a drink, you know what I'm saying? That might create a moment that you can't, that might stop a moment that you can't get back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or if you like, if you feeling like, oh, I'm decked out, but I can't even afford a ginger ale, that might make you feel some type of way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so the goal has always been, you know, like Whiskey Boys, one of the foundational ideas was come as you are.
Free events.
Not necessarily free events, but, free in the sense of, well, so like if you can afford a $30 ticket, once you're here,
you can afford a ginger ale.
The ginger ale is all of this shit is free because you're here, right? And you're here because we want you to be here, right? And so the idea of like once you step into a Baldwin and Friends, like who gives a fuck if you didn't read the text? That shit don't make a difference. You got some perspective, on what Baldwin talks about, you know, like with this next, the Schomburg Baldwin and Friends, you got a perspective on space. You got a perspective on space as a black person, space as a woman. You know, like, you know, we talk about, you know, women riding a train or women in bodegas and they looking good. I mean, you know, and they want their space.
Yeah.
Or you got your degree and, you know, you want your space. Where am I in this narrative?
Yeah.
And so, you can speak to that. And so it doesn't matter what you have or have not read. You can contribute. You're an intelligent person. So, like, this ain't a pissing contest, for lack of a better word. Like, you know, for who's read deeper into Baldwin's work, you know?
Okay. All right. Well, with that being said, everyone, I think, again, we definitely got a lot out of this conversation. Definitely follow Busy Barn and Whiskey_Boys_ENT on social media. I'm pretty sure you will find yourselves enthralled with the amount of work that you put out. I'm a social media scroller. This is what I do. I mean, I'm not just a lurker. I do like, I do press like, and I do, you know, participate. But I am very aware of what I see on social media. And so I definitely think you're off to a very, very great, I mean, it's not even a start. You've been doing this. So what you're doing is great. It's amazing. I don't co-sign people very often. I don't tell people. Well, I don't lie to people. So definitely, I think you're doing great things. And I look forward to going and being a participant to your James Baldwin and Friends.
I appreciate that.
On July 29th.
Yeah, man. You know, I think It's always a thing that people walk away with more than what they came with.
Definitely. Definitely. And I think it's just a great space for, you know, I always consider myself like a Black intellectual. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to have degrees to be an intellectual. And no. So I think that it's always great to be with like-minded individuals, whether we agree, disagree, whatever the case is, mm-hmm. but we're in a space able to engage, because we don't get enough of that in regular everyday life. We don't.
Yeah.
So great platform for that.
I appreciate that. And I mean, you know, and if anybody who's, you know, hearing this information, you know, about Baldwin and Friends, you know, one of the things we discussed like offline was that this is not a space where, you know, people are feeding you their opinion about this text. It's about who you are and how you understand these mm-hmm. ideas. And your opinion is valid. So, yeah. You know,
and that's what's important.
Yeah.
So. And last note, the intern, if you're listening, Whiskey Boys Entertainment is looking for an intern.
Like, all this shit is stocked and loaded, ready to go. I need an intern. I need somebody to
some creatives.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah, creatives. So how about all y'all out there? Just send an email. Slide into the DMs.
Yeah.
All right. So with that being said, everyone, thank you so much for tuning into another episode of According to RP on WJMS Radio. And that's a wrap.
You were listening to According to RP on WJMS Radio.
About time you tuned in.
Tune in each and every Thursday.
I can't wait to come back.
7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
It's all online.